an aspect of the upcoming November election for president not getting as much attention, are the companion races for the U.S. Senate. In with analysis are UAF political scientist Alexander Hirsch and UA press director Nate Bauer.
So right now in the 116th Congress, just taking stock of the current composition of the Senate, right now there are 53 Republicans for a majority, and there's 45 Democrats, but there's two independents that caucus with the Democrats, which is to say they vote with the Democrats. And so essentially you could say there are 47 voting Democrats, which makes them the minority, and 53 voting Republicans. But there are 35 seats up for election in 2020, and some of these state contests are going to be really close. And we've recently seen a bunch of new polls and surveys released as recently as yesterday, July 7th. So, I mean, what states are you looking at? What states do you think are really interesting? And, you know, what states should people pay attention to?
All good questions. Like you said, there are 35 open Senate seats, roughly a third of the Senate. They are 12 of only 12 of those seats. It's disproportionate. Only 12 of those seats that are open are currently held by Democrats. And I think the rest, the other 23, are all Republican states. So for Republicans to have to defend almost twice as many open seats, I think is significant. And I think amongst the states that are going to be extremely close, I guess I would say most, if not all of those, are seats that are currently held by Republicans. Those include Arizona. Martha McSally is currently one of the Republicans, one of the senators who's a Republican from Arizona. She seems like she's going to be in a close race with Mark Kelly, former astronaut Mark Kelly. Colorado, Cory Gardner is a Republican senator from Colorado who seems like he's in for a fight. Susan Collins, people will be probably familiar with Susan Collins in Maine. That race seems like it will be close. And then, you know, a couple of states like Steve Daines in Montana, who's a Republican, and, you know, people might be surprised to hear that there are polls that show Lindsey Graham in South Carolina in a fairly close race. You know, Texas, we've talked before about Texas potentially becoming a battleground state. There is one Senate race. John Cornyn is the incumbent Republican senator there, who will be challenged and has the potential to be a close race. And then even here in Alaska, Dan Sullivan is one of the two senators from Alaska, and it seems like there's at least potential for that race to be close as well. I guess one of my open questions that I would kick back to you, Alex, is like there are states like that where it's hard to imagine Montana, for example, voting for Joe Biden in the presidential election, but it also seems like Steve Daines and Steve Bullock is the Democratic challenger there, like that's going to be a really close race. So sometimes I wonder, like, what's going on there when there can be such a big difference between the margin in terms of the presidential race and the margin in the Senate race there?
Yeah, depending upon the state, the down ballot effect is going to be really important. So, for instance, there's been a lot of conversation about the Kentucky Senate race, where Majority Leader McConnell is being challenged by a Democrat, the former fighter pilot McGrath, who just recently won her primary. And I was just looking at some recent polling there, and I think it's going to be a difficult uphill battle for McGrath. It looks like she's down about as much as 20 points under McConnell, which is exactly the number of points that Trump is over Biden in Kentucky, right? So you can see there seems to be a corollary effect between who's at the top of the ticket and who's a down ballot contender. So McConnell may be benefited by having his reelection chances significantly bolstered by the fact that it's an election year for the president as well. Whereas in other states, it's different. In Arizona, for instance, which you mentioned, Mark Kelly, actually, I found a poll that came out yesterday that has him up 9 points over the Republican incumbent. So that's really significant. A lot of people have been looking at Arizona. You know, overall, essentially, if the Democrats want to take back the Senate, they're going to need to win 3 or 4 seats. 3 if the vice president is going to be Democrat, right? So you can see again how the presidential contest and the Senate contests are related. They're interrelated. If Donald Trump wins re-election and Mike Pence, the vice president, continues to be president of the Senate, then they need to take an additional seat, 4 seats. And the difference between 3 and 4 seats, actually, I think is going to be very, very close, right? So if Mark Kelly is projected, you know, to win in Arizona, because he's up so many points. There's a lot of other states like Georgia and North Carolina that are too close to call. I mean, just within the margin of error. I was looking today at the most recent information we have on North Carolina, for instance. It's so tight. You know, Cunningham, who's the Democratic challenger, is up slightly, but it's within the margin of error. I mean, I think he's up on average 1.5 points, something like that.
And that's another state I think that the Senate polling so far, at least, has mirrored the presidential race polling pretty closely. I'd point out also that if we're talking about margins and the prospect of Democrats taking control of the Senate, I guess I misspoke earlier when I said that all of these close races are going to be ones that Republicans have to defend. There's also Doug Jones in Alabama, and that one will be one to watch. It's remarkable, I think, based on recent history, that Alabama has a Democratic senator in the first place. But of course, there are a bunch of contextual items about that make it unique. So it's, you know, it's always an uphill battle, I think, for a party to regain control of one of the two congressional bodies. But it seems like it's in play, at least this time around. There are other states, you mentioned Georgia, Iowa, it seems like could be close. Even the state of Kansas, which normally it would be sort of surprising to talk about Kansas as a close race or an open race, but there's an open seat. And so, and also one of the Republicans who seems likely to be, or who's in the running, you know, in the primary there, in the Republican primary for the Senate, he's a controversial figure who's had trouble in other races, in the governor's race last time, Kris Kobach. He's been a part of the Trump administration, and he has some controversial views. So that seems like that could be a polarizing and race and could be close.
Let me ask you this. Why do you think the Senate is important? What powers does the Senate have that you think there's going to be a lot at stake at whichever party manages to either keep control or reverse control over that particular area of the Congress?
Well, this time around, I guess I would say it seems like there's particular interest in who holds the Senate, because it also seems like there's the possibility of Democrats taking control of all three of the presidency and both houses of Congress. I think that that's why there's particular interest in the Senate. And for me personally, Alex, things feel so stable often when it comes to the McConnell Senate. There's consequential stuff that makes its way through or doesn't make its way through the McConnell Senate often. And I guess I think that it's illustrative for me to just kind of take a step back and think about how quickly, relatively, the Senate itself has gone from a 60-seat Democratic majority to something that seems like almost impenetrable on behalf of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans. So that's, I guess, why I have particular interest in it this time, is that Mitch McConnell, I think a lot of political analysts would say that he will go down as one of the most consequential and strongest majority leaders in the Senate's history. And so anytime you've got a figure like that who stands to lose control over the body over which he presides, that's an important story. And I'm certainly not forecasting anything, but if Joe Biden were to win the presidency and the Democrats retained control of the House, both of which at least seem legitimately possible, then who controls the Senate becomes extremely consequential, just in terms of either balancing and checking that political power or endorsing what Joe Biden and the Democrats' platform and policies would represent.
And there's some big, consequential, impactful policies that have passed the House recently that are expected to not pass the Senate, that were the Senate to kind of flip, there would be a different outcome. For instance, statehood for Washington, D.C., if there was a Democratic majority Senate right now, you would expect that it'd be very possible for Washington, D.C. to gain statehood status, which would be monumental, obviously, for people there who have, as their license plates reflect, taxation without representation. But it would also mean two additional senators for that state of Washington, D.C., which would really alter the balance of power for probably decades to come in the Senate. I also think about the Virginia U.S. Senator Tim Kaine, who's been talking a lot recently about how he'd like the Senate to move on curtailing executive power. And what we've seen, he says, both amongst Democratic presidents and Republican presidents of the modern period, you know, the last 20 years plus, you know, last 30 years, is an expansion of executive power in the form of executive orders, in the form of presidents declaring war without authorization from Congress or acts of war, and also in the realm of commerce and trade, presidents feeling like they have the power and the authority and the sovereignty to enact trade deals when actually, constitutionally speaking, according to Kane, and I think according to a lot of legal scholars, that's supposed to be the province of the Congress, right? And so Tim Kaine is spearheading that effort. It's quite a bipartisan effort. But if we see a sea change in the Senate come November, I would expect legislation such as that he's speaking of to become passed in both houses.
Supreme Court too. The Senate has a lot of control over who's on the Supreme Court and what it looks like moving forward. And those are obviously topics that are covered in the news. Donald Trump, I think, has and will continue to run based on his judicial appointments, and where it seems like in the case of at least Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it seems likely that there will be at least one Supreme Court seat open up within the next months or years. The next president and the next Senate will have a great deal to say about that.
And there's two older liberal justices. There's also whisperings and rumors about Clarence Thomas, considering retirement. So there's lots of potential for whoever the next president will be for sea changes in the Supreme Court. And of course, that's a legacy that lasts decades. That's a 30-year legacy that presidents can. Some political scientists argue it's the greatest power that presidents have is to nominate Supreme Court justices. And if that's true, if that's right, then you could argue it's one of the greatest powers of the Senate to confirm those nominations.
Alexander Hirsch is a professor of political science at UAF, and Nate Bauer directs the UA Press. I'm Robert Hannon.